Welcome to Risking Enchantment, a podcast about art, beauty, and the Catholic faith, hosted by Rachel Sherlock.
Hello and welcome to Risking Enchantment. For this week's episode, you've got myself, Rachel Sherlock, and I am delighted to welcome to the show Mary Finnegan, who is the deputy editor of Wise Blood Books. We're going to be talking about publishing today, but I'm just so thrilled to have you on the show. We met at the Ethics and Culture Conference at the Notre Dame University last year, and it was such a pleasure to get to meet you. I've been spying on the Wise Blood Books for many years now, so it was a real thrill to get to meet you.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I wanted to have you on to kind of talk about publishing as a topic, because, you know, normally on this podcast we usually take a work of art or maybe an artist or a piece and talk about it, but I would say technically I've worked in publishing. I would say it's probably closer to say publishing adjacent jobs for the last 10 years. And it's a fascinating area, but it's also one that can be kind of misunderstood, or some people have very particular ideas about what it looks like or what's involved. And I just think that it's a wonderful part of the storytelling process. And I think a lot of different art forms have it, whether it's producers in music, or there's a lot of other art forms that also have this process of having a collaborative experience kind of both during and at the end of a creation process. So I guess maybe the first thing I wanted to just ask you is, how did you get into editorial work and publishing? Because I know you weren't always in it.
No. So I have I guess somewhat unusual trajectory compared to some people. I was a nurse. I did go to college a long time ago, and I had majored in English, got an English degree. I always loved writing and reading. But at that time, there wasn't really an internet to find jobs. And when I graduated, there was, but it was, you know, the nascent internet. There would be five people that had a computer at home, and you were like, what? But I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to get into that world. Now, I did have an internship at a little free local paper in Philly, but that wasn't really what I was interested in, even though they did a lot of arts and culture. And so then, you know, I needed to have a job. So I actually went back to nursing school and became a nurse. So I did that for 25 years and just sort of kept in the writing world in one sense. I would take classes online once they were available online. And that actually, obviously in COVID, that became a huge thing where there were all sorts of things online, but it was happening beforehand.
Yeah.
And then would take classes in person here in the States. You probably have something similar in Ireland where sort of there's adult education and you can go and learn how to arrange flowers or learn about Japanese history or take a writing class. So I kept doing that, but never really knew what else to do. So I thought, well, I'll just do this and I'll be a nurse. And then COVID hit, and I found this group called Catholic Literary Arts, and it's Houston-based, but during COVID, they brought a lot of things online, reached a much bigger audience. And so I joined that group, and sort of through various different things that happened, providential, I would say, the MFA at the University of St. Thomas started, and that was all online. So I didn't have to move to the sweltering heat of Houston, Texas. And so I was in that MFA. I started that MFA with the first group, but I was still working as a nurse. I was working from home at that point for the Dark Side, an insurance company. And then at a certain point, during the MFA, I just thought, well, I think I'm supposed to quit my job and sell my house. It's insane when I say this out loud, but it really kind of did feel that way. And I thought, well, I'm going to take a chance. And I had a really great opportunity because a friend of mine works in television, has to travel a lot, but she had a little store at a beach town. And so she needed someone to run the store. So that's what I did in the meantime. So I wasn't homeless. And I wasn't totally jobless, and just thought, well, I'll see if I can find some editorial jobs, that sort of thing. And I'd done a couple things here and there. And then because of the MFA, I met Joshua Wren, who's one of the founders of the program. I took a class with him, and I'd sort of known him beforehand. And he just asked me to do a couple things for Wiseblood. Can you edit this? Can you review this? And then suddenly, I mean, really feels like I woke up one day and was working for Wiseblood and I've been doing it ever since. It's not quite what happened, but that's how I got into this part of it. Mm-hmm. So doing those freelance jobs was nothing at all like what I'm doing now, though those skills were certainly helpful. And there's parts of that, you know, doing a review of a manuscript, let's say. Yeah. But it, obviously, what's necessary to bring out a book is not the same thing as what it is to edit a book, obviously. So, which I really didn't know. So I learned from him and from other, I have some other friends who are in publishing, and they, especially my friend Paul Pastor, who works for Zondervan, he has been so helpful. He'll answer any questions and he knows everything. So that's great. And then obviously Joshua trained me. And so that's how I got into it. So kind of a weird trajectory, but yeah.
I feel like sometimes with jobs like publishing, maybe there are only weird trajectories.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's wonderful. And I think it kind of speaks to something I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, which is that sense of community, and that there is both a writing and an editing and publishing community, but also a specifically Catholic ecosphere of that as well. That feels really beautiful. And I think, yeah, because with... And, you know, Joshua Wren seems to just have such an amazing overview in founding creative writing courses and Wiseblood and, you know, doing his own writing that, yeah, it's really great to see how, you know, you can kind of be in all of these spaces at the same time as well. So they all link up together.
Yes, yes. He's really amazing because he started this. And we can talk about it more when we talk about some of the other things, but he started this, it's 11 years ago now. But sort of around the same time that Dana Gioia wrote the Catholic Writer Today essay that appeared in First Things, he had started Wiseblood. And it was just sort of, it wasn't as if he intended to go into publishing. He was a writer and he had finished his PhD. He wanted to be a professor. He was going to teach people and he was going to do his own writing and editing. Maybe he was working for Dappled Things around this time when he started Wiseblood. But he saw that there were lots of really good writers that couldn't get published anywhere but in Dappled Things. And he thought, this is crazy. These people are really good. They should have, this person should have a book. And so that's why he started it. And he knows everything. I mean, he's read everything. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
And has a really good vision. So I think his vision for Wiseblood is, which we're on the same page there, which I think is why it works. But I think that is what has helped Wiseblood to become what it has become, from just something he was doing basically in his apartment to something that has had a broader impact on the literary landscape.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic. And we're definitely going to be doing a little bit more deep dive into the books that you publish at Wiseblood and its kind of ethos and vision. And even you referenced The Catholic Writer Today. That's definitely an essay that we're going to be coming back to. But maybe before we start, I kind of said at the start, it's funny when I meet people and they hear that I'm in publishing, which like I always try to like bracket with, like I am technically in publishing, but people don't realize that like I work for a part of a much bigger company that does very kind of trade-based or practical, like people don't realize that even things like manuals or things that professionals use, all of those kinds of books also have to go through publishing processes as well. So, you know, people hear that you're in publishing and they're like, you're publishing the next great like literary fiction series or fantasy books or whatever. And you're like, well, maybe the company I work for does that, but I certainly don't. but I think there's a lot of interest in the area of publishing. I think so many people do have aspirations of writing. And so, like you said, when you were looking for a job or you were interested in writing, it can feel really hard to find how to pierce into that bubble or what that even looks like. So, you know, people meet you and they hear that you're in publishing and they want to know more about it. And I would love to maybe talk a little bit about both publishing in general, like you said, that taking a book from like conception to end product is its own full journey and there's so many areas to it. But also I'm just a huge advocate for the role of editors. I just think it's such a wonderful skill and it's something I've worked in and I am continuing. I'm actually doing some more studies to get better in it. But that like I feel like it's a very misunderstood role. I think a lot of people seem to think of it as like cutting word counts down to meet certain limits or like removing adjectives at will. I know that there are people who are kind of pushing back. I know Hayley Stewart does a lot on trying to like compare it to being a midwife, or I've seen people talk about it as like a gardener. I think those are great to help people understand, but I really want to maintain the title of editor because it's actually something that's so cool. And I used to work for a website that we would write about books and what was happening in the literary world, and that was a French company. And if you go to France, man, you can just put editor on a business card and people think you're just the most chic and the most interesting person in the room. So I'm like all here for bringing back the role of editor.
Well, I think what's interesting about this whole industry, and for me obviously it was a huge learning curve in certain ways. And yet my career as a nurse has come in very handy in very in ways that I did not imagine. And part of it is through the ability to manage a project. So as a nurse, you really need to have good time management skills, and you need to be able to sort of not just think of what's happening right now, but what will happen. Mm-hmm. While also sort of controlling that get out of control, oh, there's this emergency in the ER and we're going to, like, I'm doing this operation right now because I worked in the operating room for a long time.
Yeah.
But you need to be able to coordinate lots of different things. Obviously, there's different personalities to deal with, and to also understand what different people need in order to be able to do the best work that they can do.
Right. Yeah.
So as a nurse, different surgeons needed different skills on my part to help this case come to fruition. I needed to be able to do different things while also doing this one big thing of being a nurse in the operating room. And I think the same thing happens in publishing and editing. You know, in publishing, you had said in the questions that you sent to me, like, what's the role of a publisher? Mm-hmm. Well, simply put, a publisher brings books into the world, right? Like, that's the simplistic way to look at it. But it's a lot more than that. And then the editor, you're not just cutting down to word count. You're not just proofreading. You're not just pointing out maybe inconsistencies, that something happened on a Wednesday and now it's Thursday, but it's still the same thing is happening. Yeah. You know, these little things, but it's just easy to make those mistakes, or, you know, it's not as if writers catch all of their inconsistencies. But I think there's two things that are really important in editing and publishing, and that's being able to see what has potential and what is good, and then differentiating between whether it's good. Okay, it's good in and of itself. That's important. Is it the right fit for you as a press? Mm. And then for the editor, you want to nurture what's good, depending on what kind of editing you're doing. What's good in this piece? Is the voice consistent? And how can this writer make this work the best that it can be? Mm-hmm. And that can be really hard because I think that there's a lot of people that have this romantic notion about this whole industry, even about writing. They think, oh, like you have a dream at night and angels tell you what to write. You get up in the morning and you write it and it's just good. You know, it's just great. And writers will make fun of themselves saying, you know, I wrote this poem or I wrote this story and it's brilliant. And then you look at it after lunch and you think, oh my gosh, I want to stick a fork in my eye. This is terrible. You know? Did I really do that?
Yeah.
And I think that can happen. That same sort of inability to quite see can happen in publishing and editing. So you really have to get your own ego out of it. Mm. A simplistic way to say it would be your own unwillingness to be mean, but that's not really what it is. But you have to be honest. You have to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And again, in the operating room, there were times where I would be so afraid I know the surgeon is going to blow his top when I tell him this. He is going to freak out at me as if it's, I didn't cause this problem, but we have a problem. So you really do have to be honest, but with yourself and with the writer. And I think that that maybe is the unknown and unadmitted thing about editing sometimes. And without being too harsh, you know, some people just love their red pen and they are cruel.
Yeah.
But that's not helpful either, because I always think, you know, if you've read past a certain number of pages, there is something here that's worthwhile. And how can you nurture that? Even if you're not going to publish it, you can still encourage this writer. And that's nourishing. You know, you talked about community, the ecosystem. How do we nourish the whole ecosystem? How do we contribute to the whole ecosystem? And there's various ways to do that. Obviously, you have your primary obligation to your own press, to your own writer.
Yeah, because to me, when I've done editing work, it's actually, to me, been a real privilege, because usually I've been editing things and really appreciated the talent that I am working for. Like sometimes, again, like all things, you can just be doing a very practical job. And sometimes the proofreading element is like just the main bit of it, or it can just be a fairly dry, straightforward piece. But I've edited people who I think are just incredibly funny writers. And I always say this to my friends. I really think that being funny on paper is one of the most impressive things anyone can do.
Oh, absolutely.
And so when I'm working on that, it's like, okay, well, I see exactly what's written. And I think we have such a kind of mythology, and in some ways kind of rightly so, about the artist or the writer, or there's an element where we yearn for that kind of creative genius streak. And like, you know, if you think about it in a really big way, like maybe that's a kind of idea of our creator God, that we really believe that there is something that is like this creative genius at the center. And like, obviously there are humans who can be their kind of self-directed, self-fulfilled creative genius. But for the most part, everything requires at least some level of contribution or feedback or context in which to make it. Like I always think of it in the way that, you know, people really want the love interests in movies to actually be in love in real life. Like because they want to feel like the thing that they're seeing on screen is true in some way. And in a similar way that like when they're reading a book, like there can almost be a sort of possessiveness over saying, I want it to just be the writer and I don't want editors involved, or I don't want to feel like somebody. And, you know, I think it's because you notice it when it's bad. Maybe listeners will be more familiar with it when you kind of get to TV, where, you know, there will have been one kind of approach to a series and then it takes another turn in another series or season of it. And you kind of think, oh, I feel like there's a process, or maybe like a bureaucratic level, that is interfering with the creative part of this. But good publishing and good editing is absolutely not that bureaucratic level. It's actually working with the text and trying to make it the best that it can possibly be. Because we all know whenever you specifically are working on something, you're in the weeds. You can't always see the whole picture. You can't see the inconsistencies, or there can even just be sections that you're really struggling with, which a suggestion here or there can help you really like dive into what's not working about a passage, or like how to help things along. And so, yeah, I think it's publishing at its best, and especially editing work, is not about creating an extra level of bureaucracy. Because if you're doing it correctly, like you said, the publisher should have assessed that this was A, worth doing, and B, part of the ethos and the vision and the kind of sense or aesthetic of the publishing house. And so they'll want it to be the most it actually is. They don't want it to be somebody else's sort of corporate diluted version of it. If you believe in the project, you think it will sell. Obviously, with small publishers, this is a big thing. Can you make it sell? Can you reach a readership? But your best chance at reaching a readership is for it to be the best that it can be, rather than, I think there can be some kind of suspicion from we see there's all sometimes fingers in pots that we don't necessarily appreciate in our art.
Yeah, so I think it was Horace who said that when you write a poem, you should put it away for 8 years and not until then go, you know, wait that long before you go back to it, because you need that distance as a writer. And I think one thing that an editor can do is is be that part of those years, in the sense that you can see it with the new eyes that the, you know, most people don't want to wait 8 years. So when most writers, when you talk to them, they might say, I've been working on this for 20 years, or I wrote this poem 30 years ago, and it's taken me this long to get it to actually be what it is. Yeah. And I think that there's a couple things that happen in this whole editorial process, just in general, not even necessarily in the business of publishing. Yeah. So if you are a writer and you're part of a workshop, either you were, say, in college or you joined a workshop after college, and you sit down with 8 or 10 people and they critique your work, not all of those critiques are going to be helpful in any way, because not every one of those readers, despite the fact that they're also writers and despite the fact that they may know you very well, they may not understand what you're trying to do. They may be reading it as something completely different than what you've written. That happens. And so there's, I think sometimes people will say, well, nobody can help me.
Right.
Nobody understands what I'm doing. But I have found that that's really never true. Mm. Most people, if they're really looking for feedback, truly looking for help to make their writing better, and they want to be the best writer that they can be, then number one, they want that feedback. Mm-hmm. This is one thing I've noticed with all the writers that I know, and especially at Wiseblood, that those who really want to be the best are open to the feedback, but they have also learned, and it is something that you need to learn as a writer, what feedback will actually be helpful. So you have to be able to discern. And I mean, that happens with anything. You know, if you have a dilemma in your life and you say to 5 friends, what should I do? Well, 4 of them might give you the worst advice ever, not because they're malicious, but because they just, for whatever reason, don't understand. But there's probably someone that can really help you work through this process. And I think it's the exact same thing with writing. Finding someone who understands what you're doing, what you want to do, what your goal is, what the telos of your work is, or this particular work. It might not necessarily be exactly the same for every piece.
Yep.
Good writers are open to that feedback, and they have learned what to listen, you know, what to listen for, what to, you know, sometimes in a workshop, this will happen. Everybody points out, say, a line in a poem that's not working, but no one has the solution. That's up to you as the writer.
Right.
And so I think editors can do 2 things. They can actually say, you really should replace this word, or you should change this sentence. The cadence of it is all off, or this is so inconsistent. Like you were talking about the TV series. Sometimes you really can tell these writers are totally different. They must have fired the first group and now there's a new group. It's like a different TV show, right? Yeah. But a good editor can say, something's not right here and you need to look at this. And if you really want your work to be the best that it can be, you should take that into consideration. You know, maybe you're going to stick to your guns and say, I think I want to keep this. I was just working with one of our authors, and this was mostly proofreading things. And it's Sally Thomas. I mean, she's amazing. She's wonderful. And it was just over commas, but commas can be a really big deal, right?
Yeah.
And so there were maybe 5 or 6 instances, and it just was funny in our little exchange where she said, okay, I'll grant you that comma. It was as if we were bartering. At the comma bazaar, and we're finagling over these commas. But I think that kind of attention and that kind of work together can really make a piece better. And in this case, yes, it's a comma, but a comma can really change the meaning of a whole entire sentence. So they're not inconsequential. And then of course there's bigger things. What a character says in a story, if it sounds completely wrong, well, that can have an impact on your whole entire story, you know? So if someone points that out, a lot of times it's worth listening. But again, with that discernment, so.
Yeah. And I was thinking when you were talking about the kind of the feedback from the writing group, I think usually some of the least helpful feedback to get is to have someone sort of go, well, that's not what I would do, or I wouldn't go about it that way. And that kind of feedback isn't helpful because it's not, that's not really relevant. It's how the writer themselves should be approaching it. And I think that's what's interesting about editing work, is that actually molding yourself to be able to give contributions that are in the style or keeping, like, in keeping with what that writer is trying to achieve with their writing. And that's what's kind of interesting to me, because that's why it almost, maybe for me, that's where I feel like it's almost vocational. And obviously, like, small vocation, not like a religious vocation, but in our personal lives, the vocations that we have, which is like is specifically nurturing. And like you said, there's a balance, because there is feedback that has to happen. And that's what's interesting about especially a Catholic view of art, that there are such things as excellence and such things as standards. And, you know, things can be subjective, and some people do have tastes that inform whether they like something or not. But overall, there can be standards that we hold ourselves to. But at the same time, once you kind of assess those standards and that the person is meeting it, then it's a question of sort of nurturing. And it almost feels like raising a family, or like something that is life-giving, because it's sort of breathing life into something that otherwise might sit in a drawer for, like you said, 8 years and nobody reads it, because there's no kind of ability to feed back on the work that you are doing.
Yeah, and I think this kind of goes along with the vocation part of it, both for artists, writers, and other artists, and for those who help bring their work into the world, let's say, whether as a publisher, editor, some other role. I think there's a part that's intuition. And so for the artist, this would be maybe inspiration. And then there's just the hard work of it.
Yeah.
And both of those require a willingness to be, to interrogate yourself and your intentions, and to be honest when you come to conclusions that maybe you didn't expect to, or that you're uncomfortable with. And that can be either you're saying to a writer, like you said, we all have our tastes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't choose to read certain things. Mm-hmm. It's not my thing, but I have to read them for work. And so I need to say, well, this isn't about me. Mm-hmm. This is about the work. Mm-hmm. Though I still have to take those parts of me that are good at this and bring them to something, even though I would never read that on my own, let's say.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of, that's partly the vocation, is that with any vocation and in our own personal lives as Catholics, we have to be willing to put ourselves aside and our own desires and our own idea of how things should be, because we may not be right. Yeah. Or that's just not what this person needs. Mm. You know, if someone, you know, sometimes if you have a family member who's sick or something, and you say, I'll come over and help you, and you see, especially me as a nurse, you know, I'll see, well, this is what I should do.
Yeah.
But if that's not what they want me to do, then maybe that's no help to them at all.
Yeah.
Maybe I would actually just be making this whole experience of illness more stressful, and I should let that go. But then sometimes I have to say, listen, you really need to just let me do this because I know it will be better in the long run.
Yeah.
But how do you balance those two things? I think that that can be a real challenge, and you really have to be honest with yourself and take yourself out of it. I really do think that that's such an important thing, that we're so trained today to think that everything we do should be what makes us happy, or we should be fulfilled. You know, when I went through this whole experience where I said, I'm going to quit my job and sell my house, and, you know, this quixotic adventures, people kind of thought it was like that. I hate that story, Eat, Pray, Love. But, you know, that it was something romantic like that. And that's not how I looked at it at all, because that's not what it was. And I do think there's this tendency today to make everything about personal fulfillment in a way that isn't really about personal fulfillment at all. Because true personal fulfillment, obviously, we know is getting to heaven, right?
Right.
Becoming a saint, being who God intends you to be. And so I think sometimes he doesn't intend you to be happy today, or he doesn't intend for you to get your way, or he doesn't intend for, you know, if someone that I really love dearly wants to publish something and they send me their poem or something, and I really believe, like, don't send that out yet, it's not ready.
Yeah.
I can't lie to them. That's so uncharitable.
Yeah.
And it's not living in reality,
yeah.
right? And so I think that all that entails saying it's not about me.
Mm.
Yes, me, Mary Finnegan, I'm helping to bring this book into the world, but it's not about me.
Yeah.
It's not even about the author.
No.
It's about the work itself, right? What is the best work that we can bring into the world? Because that's what God wants. And it's an insult to everybody, including the reader, to not do that, right?
Right.
To think, well, we'll just give you this garbage or this, not that Wiseblood would ever do that, but you know what I mean? Like that whole question of to be nice to people or to be kind and not be too honest. Is it really honest to let somebody, like I had this one poem and people were like, oh, it's really good, get it published. And someone published it and I can't even think about it sometimes. So I'm like, why didn't somebody tell me this wasn't good? It wasn't ready.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have been good.
Yeah.
But now it's on a piece of paper in a journal. And I just think, ugh.
You know? Yeah. And I think that's why I'm like so interested in the work that you do, because I think, and I'm definitely part of this cohort of people who look to the classics. Like there was a golden mm-hmm. age of writing, whatever you think it was it 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you know, maybe you're a medievalist like me and you go like, let's go back 800 years. But like that we can see that there is a sense that publishing at this time doesn't necessarily feel like it's happening, especially for Catholic writers. It doesn't really feel like it's happening in a time of sort of great triumphs or like big cultural impact, which again, a bit like you were saying, sometimes it's not about you. Catholic writers these days are not likely to make a killing. but maybe God wants you to publish the book anyway, even if you're not the next flash in the pan of big fame and big success. But at the same time, I do think it's really interesting to take stock of what is happening. And like I said, this is why I found Wiseblood so interesting. And I'm looking forward to getting to read more of it, because I have admitted this, I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction. Certainly a lot of the stuff in bookstores, you know, a lot of it can come across as, I feel like saying competent is really damning. What I mean is that I'm sure that they are good pieces of writing in some mm-hmm. in some fashion, although some of them aren't. I always think of Flannery O'Connor, which obviously where Wiseblood, the name Wiseblood comes from. So mm-hmm. I'm going to use that as an excuse to do my usual and just constantly quote her. But, you know, she says something like, one can make a killing if one only learns how to write poorly enough. That
yeah.
there is a certain level of that as well. And so maybe to come back to, you mentioned Dana Joya's essay. It was first published in First Things, but mm-hmm. I know Wiseblood has since taken it and published it as a monograph, and I have it in one of your books with a selection of other essays. It was written, was it 2013 originally?
Yep.
So, you know, hard to believe it, but that's more than 10 years ago. but clearly, I know my edition with the other essays came out, it was published in 2019, so it's clearly still very relevant, but he wrote his essay on the Catholic writer today. And it's a slightly long quote, but I think I'll read it out, because I do think it's really interesting to take stock of where we are. And even to remember that, like, even in looking back, I was just going over some of Flannery O'Connor's essays on writing and publishing, and she talks about how readers don't have the equipment necessary to assess good writing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you're writing for quite a mediocre kind of audience. And so, you know, we can feel like, oh, that's a problem now. But it was a problem then as well, and maybe has always
been
a problem. But
yeah,
he says...
Well, I think what people sometimes forget with... I would never tell anyone not to read the classics. I think we should all read widely and broadly, but we should also, it's okay to read something that you love.
Yeah.
Because you love it. If this is what you love the most, that's okay. But there's another part of our literary citizenship that requires us, if we want this ecosystem to thrive, that we do need to do. But I would say we have these works from the past. We have Dante, we have Shakespeare, we have Homer. Well, that's what survived. We have no idea what, you know, maybe some of those poor writers, you know, Homer may have been experiencing something similar to writers today. We don't know, because we're just left with this. Most of it, not all of it, but most of it, the best stuff.
Yeah.
It could take 100 years. It could look at Gerald Manley Hopkins, how long it took for him to be appreciated.
Yes.
Now everybody loves him.
Yeah.
Well, the poor guy was just, you know, in a tenement in Dublin with consumption or something, yeah. right? Like he was just depressed and nobody thought that his work was good. Even his friend, who is the one that brought him, you know, without, I forget his friend's name, without him, we wouldn't know Hopkins, probably.
Yeah.
I didn't get it either. So it's so hard to tell. I mean, I think this is probably something that everyone in the arts in general, but maybe writing in particular, because visual arts and film and TV and music do something slightly different. I'm not criticizing those at all, but it can be easier on the viewer or the listener because you can go to a concert and, oh, I was at this concert and I enjoyed it.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean you engaged with it.
Right.
But it is a commitment to sit down with a novel.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to sit down with Dostoevsky, you're going to be spending some hours in his world.
Yeah.
Days and maybe even weeks in his world. So it's a different relationship, but So anyway, the Catholic writer today. So you're going to read the quote, right?
Well, yeah, I will. But I was just, it was funny when you were saying that, I was remembering back to my days where I did a master's in Viking and Anglo-Saxon studies. And one of our tasks was we had to learn the runic script and we had to translate from photographs these runes. And we had to pick like a certain set of them. And I picked, they found intact, which is insane to think about, these wooden sticks in this particular town that were the things that people just wrote everyday lists. Like, I think there's even like grocery lists in there, but there's really like very boring, average, bad love poetry in there.
Where right.
Just like under no other circumstance would you have kept these things.
Exactly. And the truth is, if you're, only human beings would write bad love poetry.
Right, right.
But if you never considered writing bad love poetry, are you human?
Right.
I mean, I think it's just part of some of this is part of the human experience, right? And not all of it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Sometimes you could be a chef and you make a meal one day and it turns out really awful and nobody wants to eat it because you forgot the salt or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, to come back to that quote I mentioned, it says, looking back on the mid-century era of O'Connor, Merton, Porton, and Tate, one could summarize the position of American Catholic literary culture with four characteristics. First, many important writers publicly identified themselves as faithful Catholics. Second, the cultural establishment accepted Catholicism as a possible and permissible artistic identity. Third, there was a dynamic and vital Catholic literary and intellectual tradition visibly at work in the culture. Fourth, and finally, there was a critical and academic milieu that actively read, discussed, and supported the best Catholic writing. Today, not one of those four observations remains true. Paradoxically, despite the social, political, economic, and educational advancement made by Catholics over the past half century, our place in literary culture has dramatically declined. In order to describe the current situation, we would have to restate each of the observations in a radically different form. And I think what's interesting in the essay is that he also points out that, like, especially from an American Catholic point of view, although this is true in a lot of other ways, that they were coming from a minority position, that they didn't have social standing, that it wasn't really, as he said, sort of permissible to be seen as Catholic in, you know, in the earlier part of this literary tradition, but that in the, especially in the mid-century, that there is this flourishing, that there is this opportunity for Catholics to take the center stage. And then, as he kind of references at the end, almost in correspondence with the kind of economic improvement of that group of people comes the decline in its sort of cultural and artistic status and place and output, which is so interesting.
Yeah, and maybe sometimes when our lives get easier, we get softer. We don't do the harder things sometimes. So any opportunity to praise Dana Gioia, I will always take it, because I think, number one, all of us who love literature and love Catholic literature And in the States, in a particular way, because he was chairman of the NEA, if you're a poet, especially because he really did a lot for poetry, but just in general, for this Catholic literary world, he has been working nonstop to help nurture any little plant, any little bud that wants to pop up in this winter that we've experienced, right? And I think what's so interesting about Dana is he's another person. I mean, the man knows everything. He's read everything. He has such a wide knowledge. He loves opera and he loves jazz. Mm-hmm. He loves Baudelaire and he loves Saint Therese. You know, he's amazing and tireless. You know, he could really rest on his laurels right now, mm-hmm. And just do his own work. He could just be concerned about Dana Gioia. But luckily, you know, through Wise Blood and through the UST MFA, I've gotten to talk to him. And he, whenever I say thank you, he always says, we're building the city of God. Mm-hmm. And that really has stuck with me. I think he did a couple things. He diagnosed problems, which is important. You can't solve a problem if you don't diagnose it, right? So if you're deluded or misinformed about what is happening, you can't really fix it.
Yes.
You know, if you have a broken leg, but someone keeps telling you that you have pneumonia, you're not going to get what you need for the broken leg. And you may get something you don't need because you don't have pneumonia, right? You don't need that antibiotic, let's say.
Yeah.
And then he also worked to help anyone who wanted to be part of this and encouraged it. So he started right around the same time he wrote this essay. He started the Catholic Imagination Conference. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a biannual conference. There was a glitch over COVID where I think they missed a year. But like this year, the Notre Dame Fall Conference and the Catholic Imagination Conference are going to be together. So that should be really wonderful.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, but he just, I think we all owe him a debt of gratitude because of how hard he has worked, but how honest he's been as well to say, well, this is what's wrong and this is what you need to do. He was a businessman, as you probably know, for a long time.
Yes.
And so he has a lot of practical skills. And those are important because you do need to have practical skills. It sounds more fairy tale-ish if it all just works out and you had a dream, you know, that kind of thing. But you do need to do practical things to make your dream come to fruition.
Yeah.
So I think the work that he has done is just incredible. And he just, the man, he's tireless. He's helped so many, although I would say he probably would say he's very tired, but he has helped so many people and he just keeps doing it. And with that beautiful mix of honesty and kindness, he doesn't pull the wool over your eyes, but he's not cruel about anything or dismissive, which I think is important. It's easy to say, well, that'll never work. That will never work. That will never work. Well, maybe it will. I mean, if you ever hear him get the opportunity to hear him talk about the first Catholic Imagination Conference, he had no money. He just convinced people to pay for this, to bankroll this, to get people to show up. And it went really well. And it's still going now, 10 years later. But I do think that some of these things are changing a little bit. Mm. I think that writers identifying themselves as faithful Catholics, I think that's changing. If you look at someone like Phil Klei, who won the National Book Award, he's a fiction writer and he writes nonfiction. I love his work. He's an amazing writer and thinker and critic. And Christopher Beja is another one. He identifies as a Catholic. He was a cradle Catholic, kind of fell away, came back. And both of them in their work, that other realm of the world, the beyond the material, the spiritual realm, that's included in their work. And they are, you know, quote unquote, famous writers. Mm-hmm. They're both big deals and they're just two examples.
Yeah.
So I think some things are changing. And I actually think that what you said about community, it comes back to that. I think more people are finding each other.
Yes.
What's interesting about the MFA at UST, because this is, people love to hate on MFAs. You know, they, even Flannery had some things to say about MFAs. They don't squash enough writers, right? but this MFA that James Matthew Wilson and Joshua Rent started is very different for lots of reasons. Because of the two of them and probably some help from Dana, their goal is not just to churn out writers. It's or to make their own money back. Do you know what I mean? It's not a grift.
Yeah.
I think what was interesting when I first started that program, almost everybody in it, and some of us were older, some of the students were really young, all different ages. There was an 80-year-old priest and then, you know, 22-year-old recent graduate in the program. Everyone said, oh, this is what I've been looking for. I can't believe I found this. And so whatever is happening, that community is getting solidified in certain ways and kind of growing. And it probably has to do with multiple factors, some of which are the result of just the insanity of the modern world. And some of it because of like the hard work that people like Dana have put in to build this ecosystem. You know, there's good ground now that we can plant in, and that's what's happening. So I think that part is definitely changing. And I think the church still doesn't really nurture artists the way that it could and has in the past. So that probably hasn't changed very much. And it should. Dana wrote a book, a monograph that he wrote. I think it was an essay in First Things recently, maybe a year or two ago. I can't remember. But it's a monograph now, a little hard to see, but it's Christianity and Poetry. And so it's basically saying the church, you know, our faith, the Catholic faith, the Bible, poetry is part of it. It's integral to this. And you can't really understand your faith if you don't have some understanding of poetry.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a little disconnect between the institutional church and art in general, not even just literature.
Yeah.
I think maybe not so, like sacred music probably gets, but that's different because it's part of the, at least some services. I mean, some are maybe their music isn't so sacred or good, but that's another podcast episode, right?
Yeah. I think we referenced that original article in First Things, which is now a monograph that you were saying there of Dana Joy's essay on poetry in our episode on kind of everyday poetry. And actually, as you're speaking there,
oh yeah, that's right, I remember that. Yeah, I did listen to that. Yeah,
as you were speaking, it was kind of making me think of Dana Joy. And I'm sure our listeners will remember from our poetry episode, but also, you know, if you need a refresher, like he's such an acclaimed poet in his own right. And what you were saying was kind of actually reminding me of my other favorite T.S. Eliot, which is like T.S. Eliot was obviously acclaimed and recognized and did get the public recognition for his poetry while he was alive. But he was also so instrumental in encouraging other people and working in favor and trying to bring people on and promote other people. And that even like that strange correlation of him having come from like a banking and a business background as well, mm-hmm. that like there's that practical element to it. And yeah, and that, and being part of those movements and communities of writing as well. And so yeah, it definitely feels like he's sort of in a oddly similar position in that way. But I think
that's a really good point, actually, because I was thinking about Eliot when I was reading some of your questions, because I think one of the really important things that he also did was his approach to criticism and the role of criticism. And that can kind of get forgotten in the romantic view of literature and writing, mm-hmm. and the artist, mm-hmm. we can forget that the critic has a really important role. And when we don't have great criticism, that does have an effect on literature and on writers, mm-hmm. because I think on different levels, number one, can a writer really totally interpret their own work? I mean, you have your intention when you write it, but that doesn't mean you really 100% get it. It does need to be interpreted, and to place it in the literary landscape, which is really important, and to teach readers how to read.
Yes.
You know, that was one of Eliot's big things. And I think he was right about that. If we don't have good critics, then a lot of times we don't have good readers.
Yeah.
And so if you have a critic who just never, it would be equally bad to say that everything was terrible as to say that everything is good, right? Neither of these are reality. So you can take a work as a critic and say, well, this is where it's good and this is where it's not working and this is why.
Yeah.
And that helps readers learn how to discern and evaluate work on their own and therefore hopefully appreciate good writing better.
Yeah.
And I do think that if you, the more you learn about, you know, obviously there's that first experience of enjoyment with a work of art.
Yeah.
If you go to a museum, listen to music, any work of art, you have that first experiential exchange with this. And that's amazing. Dana Gioia talks about that a lot. Art is an experience. Literature is an experience. Poetry is an experience.
Mm.
But then when you understand it more, that can really enrich your joy because you realize then, oh, this writer took something from, I don't know, Norse mythology, let's yeah. say. And that deepens your understanding and your pleasure,
mm-hmm.
right? Like we don't mm-hmm. analyze to destroy, we analyze to understand.
Yep.
And I think Eliot, his work in that area is really, really important. And I think he gets credit for that, you know, obviously. And partly he was doing that so people would understand what he was doing because some of his more obscure work needed an interpreter. And
yeah.
in some ways, he was one of the only people that could interpret it at that point. And Dana kind of does the same thing too. He really works a lot as a critic to try to, and I, in an effort to help writers and to help readers.
I think that's so interesting because a big part of what I was interested in this topic is not just how do we cultivate good writing, but how do we cultivate good readers? And there's a balance. I think I know that the aim isn't only to appeal to intellectuals or appeal to a very niche subsection of a population. But at the same time, and especially I think for people who listen to this podcast, there are people who are not professionals, they're not academics, but they do want to actually take some serious interest in their reading. And I think mm-hmm. that should be something that is encouraged. And, you know, not everyone will always have time. Again, I think Flannery says this, like art is not for everyone all the time. But at the same time that in general, we can encourage a community and a general readership that actually can identify and can assess what they like and don't like. And I actually try to stay away from this part of the internet a bit, which is the kind of general reviews of stuff of books on whatever it is, like TikTok or YouTube or any of these things, mm-hmm. because a lot of the time what they're doing is just actually rating the experiential thing that you were talking about, which is mm-hmm. I enjoyed reading this book, but they don't have any tools to talk about why it's good. And there's even like pushback from people, especially authors, and this really gets into it, which is like, again, the balance between excellence in writers and knowledge in readers, but saying that like, oh, if you didn't like a book, don't review it. It just wasn't for you. Like people genuinely say this now, and it's kind of crazy to me to think that there couldn't be genuine feedback on your writing that might say this is lacking in some way and that we could aspire to better. I see that actually mainly in a more secular space because it's more things that like crop up on social media or, you know, it's not necessarily coming from the Catholic space, but I think the Catholic space has an equally difficult space to navigate, which, and we've referenced it a little bit already, which is this question of niceness, because it feels like mm-hmm. Catholics ought to be nice. That's one of the, you know, it gets elevated to a virtue. And I'm not saying there's no virtue in being nice, but that like in and of itself, it's not really what we should be aiming for, either as people criticizing or responding to writing, or from the other side in terms of like promoting and writing ourselves and getting feedback on our writing. And so I know in the essay that we've been referencing, the Catholic writer today, Gioia says that there's a crippling naivete among many religious writers and even editors that saintly intentions compensate for weak writing. Such misplaced faith or charity is folly. And it really reminds me, you know, I'm going to keep going on about Flannery, but she does really hit the nail on the head in her essay, Catholic Novelists and Their Readers. And again, this is a slightly long quote, but bear with me. She says, every day we see people who are distorting their talents in order to enhance their popularity or to make money that they could do without. We can safely say that this, if done consciously, is reprehensible. But even oftener, I think we see people distorting their talents in the name of God for reasons that they think are good, to reform or to teach or to lead people to the church. And it is much less easy to say that this is reprehensible. None of us is able to judge such people themselves, but we must, for the sake of truth, judge the products that they make. We must say whether this or that novel truthfully portrays the aspect of reality that it sets out to portray. The novelist who deliberately misuses his talent for some good purpose may be committing no sin, but he is certainly committing a grave inconsistency, for he is trying to reflect God with what amounts to a practical untruth. Poorly written novels, no matter how pious or edifying the behavior of the characters, are not good in and of themselves and are therefore not really edifying. Now, a statement like this creates a problem. An individual may be highly edified by a sorry novel because he doesn't know any better. We have plenty of examples in this world of poor things being used for good purposes. God can make any indifferent thing, as well as evil itself, an instrument for good. But I submit that to do this is the business of God and not any human being. I think that's so great. And I know she says in another section where she talks about how when Catholic writers get this conflict of themselves, they tend to seem to want to save the world rather than save the work. And actually the thing that they need to be focused on is the work.
Yeah, you know, I think this probably goes back in a lot of ways to vocation and to doing what God intends us to do. Like, if our goal in life, right, should be to be who God intended us to be. Mm-hmm. And that's a process that we are going to fail at over and over again, but hopefully eventually get it through our thick skulls and get it right at some point. And I think some of the same things can happen with just as artists, that instead of doing the hard work of writing the best thing that you can do, you find a reason why you can sort of skim a little on the top, right? Where you can say, well, this will edify someone, or the point of this is the lesson here. And I think that that is not doing what God wants you to do. It's not charitable to the reader, just as lying to one of your friends would not be charitable or to a child or a family member or a coworker. It doesn't accomplish anything, really, because now that person is able to add one more unreality to their little pile of unreality, or you are yourself, right? Yep. Which you can't fully live if you're not living in reality. And so I do think that maybe this was always a problem, and it probably has been maybe more so over different times, but I think we've definitely gone through, and maybe we're coming out of it, I hope so, a real era of, well, it's pious, well, it's good. And I think it probably happened a lot in movies, these Catholic or Christian movies that were terrible. They were terrible. How could you even sit through this thing? And here, movies are like $12. Like, you just wasted all this money and all your time.
Yes.
And somebody made that, and it's not telling the story of whatever saint or of these people that it's trying to portray. It's lying about them. And so I think that as artists, the desire to be accepted is probably something that different people struggle with more than others. You know, some people are just like naturally contrary and they can kind of stand athwart the mob sort of thing. But especially in the time of social media, it's like people want to be accepted, right? You want to be praised. You bring your piece to workshop and it feels great when people say, this is so good, I love it, right? But do you want that momentary good feeling, or do you want to make something that was worth making? Because that's why God put you here. You know, a parent wouldn't say, well, I don't really care how my kid turns out, so I'm just not going to take care of them. I'm not going to give them the right food or the right education. That would be bad parenting.
Yes.
So why is it any different for an artist?
Yeah.
Just because it makes you feel better? I think this whole like wanting to feel, and I mean, I suffer from it just like anybody else. But if you want to be an artist, you have to get a thick skin and you have to be as hard on yourself as you are on other people. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a way to do that without being discouraging. It's how can I do this better?
Yes.
Right? Like if you went to confession and the priest said, well, hopeless case, you just, I'll forgive you, but I'm telling you, there's no hope for you. Well, you wouldn't keep trying, right? Like it's go and sin no more.
Yeah.
And so not that I'm equating,
yes,
you know, writing a poem with becoming shriven or anything like that, but just think, how can I do better?
Yeah.
And so it's funny, like this is another place where nursing really comes in handy, at least in the States, and maybe it's the same in Ireland, that nursing can be a very pejorative profession where people are always, and medicine in general, they want to find blame. Who can I blame? People love to have the scapegoat, the person to blame, often so they can step back and say, oh, well, it wasn't my fault. But usually disaster isn't one person's fault, right? So, or something that really goes wrong. Usually there's a couple steps that were involved in, in that occurrence. And so I think the better way is to say, let's look at it. Like if somebody really wasn't negligent or if a doctor committed malpractice, those are different things and need to be handled differently. But yet at heart, we can say, okay, this is what happened. This was my part in it. I messed up. I didn't see something. I misunderstood something. I didn't ask a question I should have. And you look at all of it. You look at the big picture and your role in it. And you say, okay, how can we make this not happen again? Well, I think you can do the same thing with artists, right? You don't have to say, you're hopeless. And, you know, I don't know, maybe if the person is hopeless, but if they, that's a different question, I guess. But say, how can you do this better? What are you trying to do? And how can you do this better? Because what's the goal?
Yeah.
Is the goal that you feel good for 5 minutes or that you write a really good poem or a really good story?
When I hear this, I'm just really struck by how much I really love the art form that is writing. And I think maybe where some of the extra layer of where we kind of encounter a lot of wanting to be nice is that there are probably more people attempting to do writing than most of the other kinds of art forms, because it's a lot more straightforward to say, well, I want to be a concert pianist, but I can't really play piano. It's sort of a lot quicker to be self-evident. And, you know, again, once again, another Flannery O'Connor quote, but like, often it is as noble not to write as to. And that's not to discourage people from writing, although it is worth reflecting that God has given talents to people. And maybe that's, and maybe you need to explore that, but maybe it isn't. And like, maybe there's something else that you're being called to do. But even like before you kind of get into the weeds of like worrying about whether you're really called to be a writer or not, that like, because for the vast majority of us, we are literate, anyone can sit down and put some words together and say, well, that tells a story. And, you know, I would love to explore more about what you were saying with the MFA, the Masters in Fine Arts, and like creative writing, and what does the kind of teaching around that involve? There are different approaches to saying like, how much is something like creative writing teachable in a practical way? Because you're not, again, once again, you're trying to bring out people's voices rather than teach that there's one way that you go about writing. Because like, obviously, Hemingway did not write the same way as Jane Austen. But I always think of actually Picasso, and, you know, some people don't particularly care for his paintings. I actually like quite a lot of his work. But when you go back to early Picasso work, he can absolutely do the sort of great masters, not hyper realistic, but like very realistic paintings. I think as a very young child, he painted pigeons, and his father, who was also an artist, saw it and was like, I'm going to give up because my young son can do this better than me. So he went off and he then did crazy distortions and colors and changed the way that we kind of approach visually representing things. But he had the actual skills to begin with that understood the tradition and had the talent and had the whole tradition behind him, that he wasn't just saying, well, I can't do that stuff, and so I'm going to do my own thing. And I think, again, it's hard with writing because it feels like a much more accessible form of creativity and expression for people, which is great. And like, you know, also to remind people that it is also okay to make art for just yourself. Like, I think I'm going to be doing an episode sometime soon about creating music. I don't ever anticipate creating music professionally, but I have recently reignited a love of doing it with my friends, for my friends. And that, like, not everything needs to be on a public stage or become a professional. You can do things, even if you feel like you're not the best at it. Maybe your voice isn't great. Maybe you're never going to have enough time to learn an instrument to a sort of performance standard. But that doesn't mean that there's no value in doing it just for you and your friends. But if we're talking about doing it professionally, sharing it with the world, expecting people to respond to it and have opinions on it, that there are actually, writing is a craft that you should absolutely love. Like, if you want to be a writer, you should be in love with writing. Like, one of the things that I love about the classics is these very distinctive voices that come across, that the way that Dickens writes a novel is so specific to Dickens. Mm-hmm. The way that Chesterton writes a story is so specific to Chesterton. And not that you should be trying to mimic other people, although there can be like some benefits, like we said, like copying the old masters and figuring out how it works, and like sitting down and being like, okay, well, what's actually happening in there? But you mentioned earlier about like caring about a comma, but to me, like, as someone who loves writing, that's like absolutely where I'm at. There's a series, I don't know if you know it, it's like a middle grade series called A Series of Unfortunate Events, which has a character, I think, in the third book, who says there is no joy in life like grammar. And my friends always joke that that's my motto, but it's because to me it is actually genuinely interesting how sentences are constructed, and it works in all kinds of ways. Like, I suspect on some level I get it from my dad, who is actually very good at putting words together, but has not worked in that area. He was in business, but he would call me up. He would actually read contracts and find things that in contracts that nobody had. Everyone was just scanning them and being like, that's fine. And he's like, no, if I'm going to sign something, I'm going to read it. And then he'd call me up and, like, obviously nothing confidential, but he'd be like, what do you think of like this comma here? Does that not change the meaning of this? Do you think?
Yes, it does.
And if that can be true for a legal context, like, I always think a bit about, and I know this is because it's in translation, so it's not exactly accurate, but Jesus on the cross, I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise. So is he saying it that I'm saying this to you today, you will at some point be in paradise? Or am I saying that today, this very day, you will be in paradise, right? You know? And those things that, like, actually caring about how we construct our writing is actually a beautiful thing. Like, it's a craft. It's just like any of the other artworks. And I think that's kind of interesting, because I think that will in turn help foster greater readership. Because, like I said, there is a balance when we're talking about all of this excellence and this nuance. I'm sure the vast majority of people who pick up a novel are not agonizing over whether there's a comma in a clause or not. But at the same time, there has to be an aspiration on both sides to write better and to be better readers. And that's the only way that we actually get truly great writing that hopefully in 100 years' time, people will look back and say, man, that really stood the test of time.
Yeah. So I think because we live in a very emotional age, right? Your feelings are the most important thing. People have forgotten that the first purpose of writing, just writing, is to communicate something.
Yes.
Not to express your feelings.
Yeah.
Your feelings are valid, maybe, maybe not. You're certainly entitled to express them. And there is an assault on language just in general. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we know this. You couldn't live in this culture and not recognize this, yeah. I don't think, unless you were choosing to put blinders on about it. But if we can't communicate with each other, which actually good grammar helps to do that, it's one way that facilitates this communication, then we have a big problem. We can't live together. We can't have a society. A society needs to be able to communicate properly the truth, reality. So these things are actually huge just on a fundamental level.
Yeah.
But I think on the artistic level, you are trying to communicate this vision that you have to your reader, to other people. And so what is the best way to do that? And it really does help to learn the rules. Mm-hmm. I think what the Picasso example is so interesting, because there's maybe, you know, this is a little bit of a fascination with breaking the rules. Mm-hmm. People love breaking the rules, but if you don't know them, then you're not breaking them. You just don't know them.
Yeah.
But also, if you're breaking them, why? What is the purpose of breaking them? Mm-hmm. So if someone's going to put a sentence fragment in as opposed to a whole sentence, what is the purpose of that? What does it communicate? What is it doing, say, in the poem or the piece? Mm-hmm. And that requires being strict with yourself, right? Being saying, well, this is what a full sentence does. And so this is what I want this fragment to do. I mean, I'm just pulling out an example, but we see this all the time, like leaving out that comma, what, Am I trying to instill confusion? Do I want to create a sense of misunderstanding in this, say, in a dialogue? Mm-hmm. Or am I just doing it because it's fun to break rules? Like, and that's just stupid, right? Like, that's not art if you're just doing it because it's fun.
Is there a reason you're not putting any capitalization in your poetry?
Exactly. Why are you doing that? And if you have a reason,
yes,
then that's different. Mm-hmm. Someone mm-hmm. is still entitled to disagree with that, mm-hmm. to think it doesn't mm-hmm. work or whatever, to not like it. But that's different than just pretending that you're breaking the rules when you don't even know the rules. You brought up the MFA, and I think this is so interesting. You know, I'm on Twitter. I have to be on there a lot for work and for volunteer with Dappled Things as a social media editor, which is kind of funny because I'm not really a social media person, but it's really fun to do because I do like to praise other people and say, like, look what my friends did, or this person who I'm not friends with them, but I really like their work, mm-hmm. and to just promote good writing. But I think the way that Joshua and James have just designed this MFA, I can guarantee you, I'm on the poetry side, and I know James that would not say that everybody is as good as everybody else.
Yes.
We are all equal in the eyes of God, but we are not all equally gifted with talent mm-hmm. or the ability to work hard for whatever reason. I mean, this is something I think you were talking about, there's lots of writers today, lots of aspiring writers. This is absolutely true because it's so much easier to get pencil, paper, everyone has a computer, you can get your blog, you can self-publish. And frankly, I think a lot of people will just say, oh, that's so good. They might not even read it. I mean, mm-hmm. if you've ever posted anything on social media, like I'll post some of my work on social media and I appreciate everyone who reads, but it's interesting because you can kind of tell who actually read it.
Yeah.
So some people are praising it, but they never actually read it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not really praise. It's kind of hollow. I mean, it's sweet that you want to be encouraging, but it's not really, I don't know what you're praising. Like, you just like me. And so you want to be nice, right? Yeah, that word again, nice. But I think that, the MFA is trying to give students the artistic, philosophical, and theological background that we need to do the best work that we can. And that is not going to be the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's not, because some people are more talented than others, and some people are more devoted to their art than others. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for someone to say, I just want to be a better writer. I'm not interested in being even published. You know, I think there are people in the program that maybe that's not their primary concern. They have a different concern. And the craftsmanship, on the poetry side, James wants everyone in this program to learn how to write verse. We are learning prosody. We're learning all we need to know about versification. Mm-hmm. So you may choose to write in free verse, but you will know how to write in iambic pentameter. And you will understand, and overall with the program, is to understand where now our time, where we fit into the tradition, but what is the tradition? Where are we coming from, right? Like, and I think it's interesting because if you got onto a bus and the bus driver said, hey, I don't know how to drive. This is first day on a bus. I usually walk everywhere. I've never taken a lesson. Well, you would get off the bus, right?
Right.
Like, and if someone said, was he a good bus driver? If you didn't find, you know, you don't know until after you've crashed into a tree, you'd be like, no, he was terrible. He didn't know how to brake. He didn't know how to accelerate properly. He couldn't merge. And now, you know, we hit a tree. Well, why do we accept artists who also don't know what they're doing? Mm. Like, why is that okay?
Yes.
What is the purpose of that? Like, I actually think that people having a hobby or just loving music or writing or art, I think that's great. I think everybody should be doing that if they can, if they're so inclined, I guess. And I think we should be nurturing it in each other and in kids. So yes, maybe you're not going to be you're not a great singer, mm-hmm. but you enjoy mm-hmm. singing and it's pleasant to listen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not Pavarotti, but okay. When we sit around the kitchen table, someone plays the piano, someone else sings, and we have we sit there, have our tea and enjoy ourselves. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. And I think that actually nurtures the more talented. So if you grow up in a family, writing is like in your family, your father had respect for writing as a means of communication mm-hmm. and as a way to understand each other and the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. That nurtured your love of writing and probably made you a better writer, mm-hmm. really, right? Mm-hmm. And better at participating in this whole industry.
Yeah.
So those things are really good and we should be doing that. And then just like if you want to be a gardener and you like just gardening in your backyard and you plant some vegetables and some flowers and you give those flowers to your friends or you make pasta sauce with the tomatoes, that's all great. But maybe your child learns and becomes a farmer and that's a profession for him. So, these different levels are all nurtured and they nurture each other, right? Like mm-hmm. the leaves fall, they die, they nurture the ground, and then we have better fauna and flora in our ecosystem. So it's the same thing. I don't think that lying to someone and saying you're a brilliant singer when you're not. I mean, obviously, like I have lots of nieces and nephews and the really little ones were like, oh, you're so good. And sometimes it's like, well, you know, I mean, you're not great. You're not going to say that to a little kid, right? Yes. You let them enjoy themselves. And maybe that not so good, they will actually grow to be really good because they love this.
Yeah.
So they do have this latent talent that you just can't see because they're three, right? And they just are silly and they're just enjoying themselves. They're not trying to please anybody. They're not trying to perfect their talent, but as they grow older, they might. And so I think the same thing happens in literature and we should be encouraging all of that.
Mm-hmm. And the way to help foster the real talent is to actually become better readers, because if you're a good reader, you'll recognize when you're not living up to the mark in your own attempts as well. And that being in this creative, encouraging atmosphere, but with the same idea that there are standards and like this is what is a great example of this. This is what is the best that this can be. And we can all participate in it in a small way. And maybe you keep trying and you do foster that talent for yourself. But I think knowing the limits of your own talent comes from actually being keyed into what you know to be good and understand what makes something really good. And I was thinking, you know, maybe to move to our last little bit, which is that you were talking about verse there. And I was thinking about the masthead for Wise Blood Books. And like, I remember reading it that you said that one of the things that you look for verse devoted to the preservation of form in an age of unmaking, which I thought was really beautiful. And even like at the start of this episode, you were talking about like that need for the truth. And it's funny because I think sometimes when people think about fiction, they're like, what do you mean the truth in fiction? But, you know, just because you're on Mars or just because you're in Middle Earth doesn't mean that there isn't a true human experience happening there.
Exactly.
And so, you know, the kind of the last sort of line of the description for Wise Blood is that like you're looking for books that incite our hunger for the splendor of truth. And I love that term, which is that like not only is it the truth in a sort of very legalistic or logical kind of way, but that there's something creatively beautiful about the splendor of truth. So like, I mean, maybe do you want to just take us through a little bit of what Wise Blood, the kinds of books that you publish or the writing that you promote and just the kind of ethos that you have with that?
Yeah, so I would say that with Wise Blood, our goal is to present through literature the entirety of the human experience, right? Which is not just hard material world, that's part of it. You know, the desk that I'm sitting at is part of the world. It's a real thing. But those who've come before me, my parent, you know, people who've died, like the communion of saints, kind of looking at it in that way, that we are here for the living and the dead and those to come. So we want to create books that is in service to the human experience. Mm-hmm. And I do think, I really believe this, that literature can, not in a didactic way, but teach us and help us understand what it means to be human. Like this story, Dana Julia talks about this a lot. Stories, in particular poetry, but just stories in general, are part of the human experience. Every culture has created poetry. Every culture has sung, right? Because that's what poetry originally was. Every culture tells stories. Like that's how we know what happened in ancient Greece, because someone told a story, mm-hmm. right? That's how we understand. You're a medievalist, like you understand the medievalist world through their stories. Now, some of those stories may be historical accounts, so they're less, say, creative. And then some are actually stories. Like, think about Christian Lavransdatter, how much reading that you learn what it was like to be alive then mm-hmm. and find out there's so many things that are exactly the same as being alive right now.
Yes.
You know, sometimes women choose the wrong fella. Their life is really hard because of that.
Yeah.
Let's say. But I think, so Wiseblood, you know, we're interesting because we're a smaller press, a smaller nonprofit press. So it is hard to survive. Modernity's machine is always coming for the small and always has. It's why partly why we still read Tolkien, right? So there are lots of challenges there to try to bring these books into being. But we hope that we can, we do bring out reprints. So like this year we brought out a reprint of Under Satan's Sun by George Bonanos and The Demons by Hamito van Doder. Along with, usually we have other, we'll have an introduction, let's say. Like Dana Joya did a translation of Seneca, and he wrote the introduction to Seneca's Hercules Forens, one of his plays. And he kind of said, like, we should be reading Seneca today as an artist, and this is why. So, you know, that was a translation, and that was a little bit different than just bringing out, reprinting something. So we try to do that. We try to do them in beautiful editions. So the aesthetic experience of reading is important. So it's not just, you know, thrown together or slapdash. We want the cover to be beautiful and what's inside to be beautiful. And then we really try to foster contemporary fiction and poetry and essays. I mean, so we've talked about a number of those. So a lot of times what will happen with the essays is that it'll start off as something smaller, say in First Things, and then Wiseblood would say, do you want to write more extensively on this? And we would have them put out the monograph. And those are great. Like those are so interesting, I think, mm-hmm. and really unique mm-hmm. and special because they come from all different angles. You know, Christianity and Poetry by Dana Joya, or How to Think Like a Poet by Ryan Wilson, but also What is the Ideology by Mark Schiffman, which is a more, you know, political academic work. So we do those, and those are in beautiful editions. And then, of course, new artists. So like in April and May, we have two new poetry collections coming out. And they're actually a mix of formal poetry and free verse. Both of them are so good. Anna Lewis's Memory's Abacus, beautiful. She's has a young son. And so a lot of it's from her experience as a mother, but also just memory and the role that plays in our lives and how generative these memories can be in our daily life. And then Dan Rattel he's kind of interesting. He's from Massachusetts, so New England. So there's this Robert Frost element to his work. And then he went to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And so it's kind of like New England meets the Celtic world or something like that. I don't know. It's right. It's really interesting. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of Frost in his work. So both of them, it's their first collection. So we are always open to publishing, like, and Anna Lewis, actually, I should say, she's, I forget what she does. Like she just works in the business world. Mm-hmm. So she's been mm-hmm. writing poetry for years and she's gotten published in First Things and other places, but she's not in the literary world.
Right.
Dan Rattel is a little bit more, he has a chapbook out. He obviously went for his MFA in writing at, University of St. Andrews. And then with, newer fiction, Sally Thomas, we're going to publish her collection of short stories in August. It's so good. You're going to love it. I really love these stories. And she's a poet primarily.
Yes.
But she wrote this, her novel, Works of Mercy, that we also published. and now this collection of short stories. So she's definitely more well known as a poet, but I think her stature as a fiction writer is rising. And like I said, she's just wonderful. So you can see, like, we kind of do a little bit of everything. We put out about 10 to 13 books a year, which might not sound like a lot, but it's a lot. Yeah.
That's a lot. From my perspective, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And, you know, obviously it's a lot of work, and there's lots of challenges. So there's a group here in the States, although I think it's international, it's called Well-Read Mom. And that's just thinking about reading and nurturing readers and finding better readers. This is one of those organizations. It started, I think, 15 years ago. I think this is their anniversary. And it's basically a book club, but now it's this huge, I don't even know how many members, book club. And you kind of join it online. They have a conference every year. But then there's local groups. And you meet up with your local group. But they also send out a reader's companion so that there's sort of criticism in there, and they do videos and all kinds of other things to help people be better readers. So it's an amazing organization. They're lovely people. And we are also reprinting Pinocchio, the original story, not the Disneyfied Pinocchio, with commentary from an Italian writer named Franco Nambrini. And he has written, he's a educator, and I think kind of like a personality in Italy, more well known than obviously he would be here. He doesn't speak English that well. Someone translated his commentary, but it's amazing. It's really beautiful. So this commentary is interspersed with the story. Now, I had never read Pinocchio, the original. I just knew the Disneyfied version. And it's really totally different story. And Franco, obviously I've never met him, but he just sounds like such an exuberant, very Italian, you know, you could just picture him like talking to you and telling you stories and his hands are going all over and there's wine somewhere and pasta and you don't even know what's happening, but it's all wonderful. So it's really, really engaging, this commentary. It's so beautiful. And what he brings out in Pinocchio and the Catholicism that's there in the story is really, really wonderful. So we've partnered with them to help bring that out in a really beautiful edition. So those are things that we kind of do that are a little different than, you know, this is a newer venture for us doing that, but it's been really fruitful and wonderful. So that's kind of what Wise Blood does. We just try to bring really good books into the world as best we can in most beautiful edition that we can. And we do also try to nurture writers that we're not necessarily going to publish right now. That's a lot harder to do because it takes, as you know, it takes a lot of time to critique a work.
Yes.
And we don't really have the resources for that. But when we can, we do that. And it may be limited. Like last year, we had an open submission period. And so we had readers. Obviously, one person can't read all of that because we got over 200 submissions. I said this to someone else. I said, I was not ready for that many. I mean, I don't know why. I guess it was just really naive on my part, especially, I mean, we just talked about how many writers there are.
Yeah.
But we opened the submission period on July 1st, and I got up in the morning, you know, did my normal thing, said my prayers, breakfast, had my three cups of tea, or I wouldn't get through the day. And then I go online and I see the inbox and there were, Rachel, I can't even tell you. I think I just sat with my jaw down on my chest for about 10 minutes. Oh my gosh. If we get this volume of submissions every day, I won't even be able to assign them to anybody, much less read any of them myself. So now they tapered off a bit, you know, they would have, and I think partly what I was surprised at is that if I had a due date, there is no way that I would send anything that I wrote the first day. There's no way.
No.
I would revise until the last possible second. maybe not the last possible second, but close to it.
Yeah.
So I think I also didn't expect so many so early. You divvy them up, different people read them and have their assessment criteria. And so with some of them, the reader, whoever read it, would say, you know, this is good, but it's just, this is the part that's not quite right. Mm. You know, I got to page 150 and I was all in, and then it got a little glitchy.
Yeah.
And so it's not a lot, but we can say to that author, well, this is what we're seeing. Now, we cannot do that for everybody.
Yes.
There's just no way. I couldn't send that many emails out in one day. But sometimes we'll try to do that when we can. And then, of course, Joshua was teaching in the UST MFA, and he does. And I'm sure, like, he and James both do lots of other things. They have their own criticism. So as part of the MFA, they're also trying to nurture the broader culture. Mm. And the broader literary culture. But so Joshua does a lot of that. And I think that that also helps writers. I'll say, like, it's interesting because it's hard. I think the one thing about a small press is that we can take a chance on things. But I also think you mentioned bureaucracy beforehand. And I think sometimes a bigger press, there's a lot of layers to go through. And since we don't have that many layers, there's less potential for someone to say no, which I think when there's a lot of layers, there can be an inclination probably to say no, especially because the volume of what you get is so high.
Yep.
And I'm sure we've all read something, a story or a poem, where either on the first reading we didn't get it, or maybe the first 20 pages, you know, a friend recommends a novel and you start reading it and you think, why would they think I want to read this?
Mm.
And then you get to page 50 and you can't put it down.
Yes.
So we have that flexibility that sometimes a bigger press might not have. And I do think that smaller presses, obviously, like there's the Nobel Prize, Juan Fossa, that was a smaller press. So I think smaller presses are really integral to the ecosystem. Particularly the Catholic ecosystem. I'm very much a small is beautiful type of person.
Yep.
And I think that we can do a lot of good. So,
I was going to say, I love diving into and forming attachments with small presses. Like when I was working in that job where I was kind of reporting and writing on books, actually one of the main things we did was do spotlights on small independent publishers. And it really kind of opened my eyes. I think that's actually how I came across Wise Blood Books, that there is a direct relationship. And actually from my experience, and I have some experience with like much larger publishers, the things that people don't realize is that then you're sort of fighting for resources within that company, that there's only so many marketing budgets, and like you can essentially have a book published with a larger publisher, but then have them essentially turn to you and say, we've got more important books that we're going to spotlight it, and, yeah, and we're not going to really do a lot for your book. Whereas a small publisher really believes in your work, because otherwise they wouldn't be publishing it. So you're actually getting someone who's going to champion your work. And like, maybe it feels like they have a smaller reach because they're not a big publisher, but you can just as easily slip through the cracks if you do manage to get in the door with a big publisher. So I'm a huge advocate for small independent publishers and for Wise Blood in particular. And I will, of course, add all of the links in the description, the website. I'll also link to, you mentioned Dapple Things, the literary journal, and I know you do the social media work with them. So I'll be sure to link all of that. Is there any other links that I shouldn't miss in the description?
Well, I definitely think you could put the UST link.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And probably Joshua's personal link. He writes really wonderful criticism that's always worth reading. He's honest about it. And I think that's so important. You know, we talked about that beforehand. And yeah, so I think, and if I think of anything else, I'll send it to you. But Ryan Wilson's How to Think Like a Poet, that's now a monograph, but it was originally an essay on Dappled Things. You know, you could probably post that because I think your readers would probably really like it. I just mentioned it in passing, but I do like to bring it up because he talks about this idea of Xenia, that being a poet, being an artist, you need to have this sense of hospitality because it's a way to, if you could ever have him on your show, he's another one that knows everything. He's really incredible. A wonderful poet. It's a way, the Xenia is a way to be a bridge almost, you know, between the material and the spiritual, between what we can see and what we can't. And that's kind of what the artist should be doing. Like, there is a reason why people look at artists as visionaries, mm-hmm. because that's, or as, you know, some people will say prophet, right? That that's the primary role. It used to be, in a way, to help people to see what maybe life distraction or less of an intuitive ability. That's what the artist can do, is help you to see better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really, it's a, the essay itself is great. And then the longer work, the monograph is amazing. So
that's so great. Yeah. I'll be sure to link that underneath. And I think that leaves us with just one more question to ask, which is, what have you been enjoying at the moment?
Oh, what have I been enjoying? So I read so much for work sometimes, and I'm in the semester still going on. So I'm reading less of my own work right now, but I mean, I'm reading less of like pleasure reading right now, mm-hmm. but I will say the one thing about working for Wiseblood is that I'm spoiled with riches, mm-hmm. because pretty much everything we publish, I get to read and I love it all. So actually for work, I'm reading, it's called A Theology of Fiction. It's by Cassandra Nelson. And actually you could, I'll send you the first things, cause that's where it appeared first. It's going to be another monograph.
Mm.
She's an academic, but I'm telling you, this woman's writing is a delight to read. You will love it. And she writes about this nun called Sister Mariella Gabel. Have you ever heard of her?
No.
So this is going to just be such an eye opener for you. She is in the vein of Flannery O'Connor, in a lot of ways. And so she was a Benedictine nun, and she taught English, and somebody said to her something basically like, well, why have none of your students won any awards? And she said, it filled me with rage. So you can just picture what kind of nun she is. Like, she's just a firecracker, right? And so she set about to teach her students the craft of fiction so well that they would win awards. And many of them went on to win awards. And so I actually printed something out that she said. Let me see if I can find it. So, because I think you would really like this. So she was really interested in quality. How do we make good writing? And kind of like Flannery, the same idea of like, just because it's pious art doesn't mean it's good art. And it needs to be good art first.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can't really be for the glory of God if it's not any good. And so there's a fiction writer. His name was J.F. Powers. Have you ever heard of him?
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah, short story writer, really good. He used to say, God doesn't like crap in art. And so Cassandra in her essay basically said Sister Mariella could be nearly as blunt. I don't think she used the word crap, but she talked about Catholic, like magazines, Catholic pulps and Catholic slicks. This was all like the 40s and 50s. And their deplorably low level of literary craftsmanship. Their sensationalism and their unrealistic depictions of an idealized and often bolderized faith, just as women's magazines consistently print happy ending stories that glorify romantic love. Sister Marielle wrote in 1942, the Catholic magazines patronize the same mentality with a subtle philosophy of life conspicuously more harmful. They seem to say, if you say your prayers, especially if they are repeated 9 successive days, if you are good and do the right things, then you shall have a job, succeed in your ambitions, be crowned with the good things of this world, a kind of backstairs entrance to materialism, particularly enticing because its easy steps are padded and comfortable with a righteous piety. Like, there's some straight fire there, right? She's amazing, amazing. To pour out miracles, 3 for a cent, cheaper than dirt, made for bad art. Isn't that good?
Yes.
So she was so good about this, basically saying, like, as Catholics, we have at our disposal everything.
Mm-hmm.
We do not mm-hmm. have a limited vision. Some people think that, oh, well, you're Catholic, so you can't write about this. But that isn't true. I mean, look at Bernanos, for one example. Look mm-hmm. at Flannery O'Connor. We have everything in the world. The seen and unseen we have available to us as artists mm. to draw from. And, but we have, you know, we need to respect that. We need to create good art so that we're portraying reality well. There were a couple other things. Oh, this is one other thing that she said that I really love. Every person present is either in a state of grace or of damnation. So if you think of a story like in Dostoevsky, in Graham Greene, in Flannery O'Connor, every person present is either in a state of grace or of damnation. In other words, heaven and hell are present in the room. A fiction which extends its boundaries to include this reality is eschatological. It embraces all planes of reality. And so that, I would say, is what Wiseblood is looking for. But I also think that that's what great Catholic art should be doing, right? Not just fiction, but all Catholic art, all planes of reality. We need to be representing them in truth as what they really are, not the bolderized version, not the pat you on the head and give you, you know, you said you're Novena, so now you're going to heaven kind of thing, because it's not true. The last thing I'll say.
Well, I feel like at this stage, I could almost say that that's the thing that I'm enjoying. That sounds so great. But you mentioned Graham Greene there. So I will say I've started listening to The End of the Affair and I am really loving it. So
it's honestly, it's amazing. He was such an interesting character.
Yeah.
The life that he led, you just don't know. And I think Graham Greene's struggle is that struggle on the page that he was probably experiencing in his heart. With the faith, it makes for good fiction.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I have had just the best time talking to you. In my head, when I started recording, I was like, I don't want to keep Mary too long, so I'll probably keep this kind of short. And here we are almost 2 hours later. So thank you so much.
Well, we're both Irish, right? I mean, I may be, my mother was an immigrant, but still we have that let's just sit and chat kind of thing. Yeah.
I love it so much.
It's all God's time. None of it's ours.
Right. Exactly. That's the way to think about it. But yeah, so thank you so much for joining. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram. I'm a little bit on Twitter. You can sign up to our newsletter on my website, which is rachelsherlock.com. But other than that, we will have another episode for you again soon. And thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This has been Risking Enchantment. Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter with the handle @SeekingWatson. And you can find out more about me and the podcast at rachelsherlock.com. Thank you and God bless.